How about you repeat after me? I know this rose will open. I know my fear will burn away.
I know my soul will unfurl its wings.
I know this rose will open. Let's try it all together. I know this rose will open. Fear will burn away. I know my fear will burn away. Soul will unfurl its wings. No, my soul will unfurl its wings. I know this rose will open. Once more. I know this rose will open. I know my fear will burn away. I know my soul will unfurl its wings. I know this rose will open.
I know this rose will open. I know my fears will burn away. I know my soul will unfurl its wings. I know this rose will open. We gather week after week. Why? To shed sunlight on that rose that is our soul so that we might open and burst forth into the loveliness of what we might become so that we could emerge like the cicada or like the butterfly from the chrysalis, uniquely ourselves, uniquely beautiful, uniquely useful to the world. One of my great privileges as a minister, as your minister, as the minister of this fellowship, is to watch people's fears burn away, to see their souls unfurl their wings, to witness how they are in service to the world and how that service grows them even more. And this morning, we have a special opportunity to hear from two of our own, from mother and daughter, Kathleen and Maeve Tanona, who recently traveled to Haiti to do a medical mission. And you may know that Kathleen is a physician's assistant, so has medical background. Maeve is an ordinary teenager. Well, no, Maeve is an extraordinary teenager. And our fellowship helped support her financially in this endeavor because we have a commitment to helping our young people find their ways to unfurling their wings. And as you will witness today, that is what is happening. So, I welcome you this morning to this witnessing of unfurling wings. And I invite you to welcome someone else near you, especially welcome someone you do not already know. Find out who they are. Maybe they, too, have wings to unfurl. Words of Alexis Engelbrecht, in this space with atheists and theists, with pagans and agnostics, with humanists and Christians, and those who reject labels, what new understandings can emerge if we listen to one another? In this space full of varied experiences, concerns, and hopes, what new revelations may come if our hearts and minds are open? In this space where we covenant to seek the truth in love and to help one another, what new ways of life may emerge and come into being? Welcome to this diverse community, united in values and guided by love. I invite you to notice the announcements in your order of service that hopefully reflect our values. There are several opportunities to engage in the world to make justice. There's a lot happening around Manhattan these days. I would especially encourage you that if you have interest in participating in the Poor People's Campaign, that there will be 40 days of action in May and June, to attend next Saturday's meeting at the First United Methodist Church. And after that, you might want to come and to the Jim Scott concert that evening here at the Fellowship. Jim's an amazing musician who I have known for more than 20 years, and I promise it will be worthwhile. He and I are developing next week's service together, which will also be a treat. And if choral music is more your style, then come the following Saturday as we honor Michael Oldfather for his many years of musical service in this congregation. That'll be on the 21st at 1:30. I remind you that if you have a joy or concern this morning, there are cards out in the narthex that you can fill out, and Dick Beeman will be collecting those during the offertory. And finally, today, the Sunday Services Committee invites you to stay after the service if you have a few minutes to provide feedback about our services, what works for you, and to hear what works for others. And with that, we enter fully into the spirit of worship as I invite Patty and George Johnson with their children, Violet and Virginia, to light the chalice.
The Growing Edge by Howard Thurman. All around us, worlds are dying and new worlds are being born. All around us, life is dying and life is being born. The fruit ripens on the tree. The roots are silently at work in the darkness of the earth. Against a time when there shall be new leaves, fresh blossoms, green fruit. Such is the growing edge. It is the extra breath from the exhausted lung, the one more thing to try when all else has failed, the upward reach of life when weariness closes in upon all endeavor. This is the basis of hope in moments of despair, the incentive to carry on when times are out of joint and people have lost their reason, the source of confidence when worlds crash and dreams whiten into ash. The birth of the child, life's most dramatic answer to death. This is the growing edge incarnate. Look well to the growing edge.
We're all on a journey, and I invite you to open the gray hymnal to number 295 as we sing out praises for that journey, raising our voices, and if it's comfortable to you, our bodies in song. I invite the children of any age to come and join Maeve as she shares a story.
All right, so I'm going to be reading Hope for Haiti by Jesse Joshua Watson. When the earth shook and took away my neighborhood, I thought I would never be happy again. Wailing filled my ears, dust filled my nose, tears filled my eyes. I helped my mother build a new home in the soccer stadium, one piece of tin, six posts, three sheets. Many people have come here to make shelters. Some kids wander around lost or wait in line for water. I am too small to compete for the food that the blue hats are passing out, so I sit and watch strangers speaking different languages quickly pass boxes towards the front of the line. In my new neighborhood, people lie in the shade of tarps, many of them injured. When I see a girl kicking a ball made of rags, I remember how we used to be happy playing before the quake. "Can I play?" I ask. "Sure," she says. We juggle the ball, trying to keep it off the ground. Other kids come running to join us. Now we have a game. I forget about my hunger as I dribble the ball through two defenders and pass it to a teammate. We keep the ball moving quickly between us like a dance. I shoot the ball between two piles of sandals and jump into the arms of my teammates like I've seen them do on TV. Both teams burst into laughter until an old woman shushes us as she passes. "This is no time to laugh," she scolds. "There is too much sadness here." As she walks away, a man nearby says, "Don't worry, children. It's not your fault. She has much to mourn, and she does not understand the power of this game." The man grins and starts dribbling our ball. "So any of you been to a game in this stadium?" Several children nod. I smile and say, "My father took me to a match here. We had a picnic with green papaya salad, and he bought me a soda. Seeing those players made me want to be a soccer star when I grow up." I remember watching Mano Sanon, Haiti's most famous soccer player, score goals on this very field, the man says. "He was just a city kid like you, no different." "Well, maybe Haiti used to be good, but Brazil is the best team in the world now," declares a boy. "We can't win anymore. Just look at our stadium." The man picks up a rag ball and tries juggling it on his knees. The rags are soaked with mud and keep slipping from the rubber bands that hold them together. "Listen, I must get back to help the others," he says, "but before I go, I would like to give you kids something." He ducks into his shelter. When he comes back out, he is carrying a ball, a real soccer ball. He hands it to me and turns to go. It is an old ball, but in perfect condition. There is a signature written on the ball, but I can't read it. A boy looks closely. It says Mano Sanon. Do you see him? He signed the ball here. All the kids gather close to see. "Wait," I call. "You can't give this ball away. It's signed by Mano." "Well, we can let go of the past," the man tells us. "Right now, we need to think about the future, and the future is you." I put my arms around the man, and the other kids all swarm him with hugs. "Thank you, mister," we all say. "Don't thank me, children," he says. "Thank you. Thank you for reminding me why there is hope for Haiti." We return to our game, playing better than ever. I pass the ball to my teammate, who traps it with his chest, then flicks it over the head of a defender. As I run for the ball, I am no longer barefoot and wearing torn shorts. I am wearing the Haitian uniform, and the stadium is packed with fans screaming out my name. I beat the defender to the ball, spin around, and glance at the net. With the Brazilian team racing towards me, I take one more step. Shoot, and... what does that say? Goal! All right.
Go. Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hearts go with you.
Each month, on the second Sunday of the month, we commit our offering to some organization, usually local, that is living out our values through their work. And this month, our offering goes to the Fairy Godmothers Fund, spreading compassion for those in need. I remind you that during the offertory, Dick will be picking up Joys and Concerns, and I introduce you to Tara Kleikamp, who is going to tell us about our Helping Hands recipient this month.
Thank you. I am here again representing the Fairy Godmothers. I am the chair for the organization this year. I know you guys had us last year again, and we thank you for inviting us back. And Therese was here to share a little bit. And so this year I'm going to share a little bit as well, and then about a new program that we have, and some stories as well of community members that we have helped. So the Fairy Godmothers started in 2006. A small group of women gathered together to realize that they wanted to change for the better in Riley County and help women that they could directly benefit. They only benefit women in Riley County. That was kind of their focus when they started the group, and we have continued that mission as well. We grant wishes in partnership with several local organizations and agencies. We have partners that help us as well in the community, different local businesses that really, they help us to stretch our dollars so that we can do more for the women. Our biggest request for women or from women in the community is beds and car repairs continues to be the most requested item that we have as Fairy Godmothers. We do have a new program coming up that was really spearheaded by our grants committee, and that committee wanted to try to find a different way to help people and really give them more of a hand up in life, not just continuing to help fix the things that they needed, but empower women to be able to help themselves. So we have a new grant program, which is called the Hand Up Grant, or the HUG Grant, as we call it. And that will be a scholarship grant for women to area vo-technical colleges or schools that will either help them attend via just a scholarship or pay for books or supplies or whatever they need, which will allow them and empower them to better their lives. And I'm going to share some first quarter stories that we have of how we have directly impacted members of our community that were shared by the grants committee. So a single mother of a teenage son receives food stamps and child support. She was working, but her teenage daughter had a mental breakdown and has a new baby. So the woman is taking care of the baby but had to give up working. She has applied for additional assistance through DCF. Her son is working at Burger King to help. Her 2004 car needs a lot of repairs. Burnett Automotive's discounted quote is just over the $800 that the Fairy Godmothers could pay, but she was able to make up the difference in that cost to get her car repaired. A 43-year-old single mother is caring for two children and one grandchild. She works a 40-hour week through Manpower at $9 an hour. She has some medical difficulties, which has left many medical bills to pay, and she is paying on some student loans. She is embarrassed about her teeth because she works with the public. Some are missing, and one needs to be extracted. Then she can be fitted with a partial plate at Kansa Prairie Dental Center, as the Fairy Godmother's grant allowed her to get this done. A woman at one of the shelters in town tried very hard to keep her marriage together, but her husband's outbursts began to threaten the children. She has lots of moral support from family, but they cannot help her financially. She is a stable, hardworking young woman. She needed beds as she reestablished her residence. The Family Godmothers purchased one for her. And the last story that I'm going to share with you guys today is about a 38-year-old single woman raising school-aged children and having dialysis appointments and some mental health issues. She receives a disability payment and works some part-time cleaning jobs. She also receives food stamps and rental assistance, in addition to the court-ordered child support that is $60 a month when it comes. She asked for a grant to help pay the cost to replace the engine on her old Chrysler, so that way she could get to work. and to her appointments. She can pay the remainder of the $134 because as our grant is $800 and the total was $934, so she was able to pay the difference. But the fairy godmothers were able to help her get her car back running and keep her life going as much as normal as possible and keep her independence. As I mentioned, we have several partnerships, but you know, there's still those times where, you know, they also have to cut a little bit off to make things happen and to help the committee do what needs to be done to help the local people in our community as women. Again, we are the Fairy Godmothers, and there's also another organization called the Guardians, which is a men's group, if any of you are interested in learning more about them. But again, I hear I only had a few minutes to talk, so I don't want to take up too much time. Just wanted to share some stories and a little bit about our mission. And again, thank you for inviting us back. I don't think
when lives are born or people die, when something sacred sensed in the soil or sky, mark the time, writes Max Kutz. We mark the times of our lives, the momentous occasions and feelings with the sharing of our personal joys and sorrows. This morning, Jane Pelletier shares a concern that her sister-in-law is suffering from mania and delusions and refuses to acknowledge her need for help, which is a very hard place to be. I would mention that Jen Campbell has a kidney infection and was briefly in the hospital, I think, over the weekend, but is out. So that's something, another concern to keep in our minds. Mark the time. Respond with thought or prayer or smile or grief. Let nothing living slip between the fingers of the mind. For all of these are holy things we will not, cannot find again.
This is an excerpt from the new book that's out called Dear Madam President. It's written by Jennifer Palmieri, who was the communications director for the Hillary Clinton campaign. I'm not even sure who you are. Are you at this moment sitting on Capitol Hill or in a state house? Are you a young teacher in Maryland wondering if you should run for something? Are you a volunteer mentoring students on the west side of Chicago? Are you browsing through a bookstore in Atlanta, wholly unaware of what your future holds? I don't know if you are a Democrat or Republican or something else. I just know that you are out there somewhere. And you are going to be different. You will bring an entirely new perspective to the office. You will expand our nation's comprehension of what it means to be a leader. In its best moments, your presidency will give us a more fully realized sense of leadership, one that combines the best qualities of men and women. There will be, actually I should have said women and men. There will be many challenges. World and congressional leaders will test you. America will judge you differently than it did your predecessors. People will scrutinize you, your ambitions, your choice of clothes. You are a unique individual, yet you will be expected to represent every woman. Be conscious of it, but keep a positive attitude. It doesn't mean everyone who doubts you is sexist. We inherited this world with all its flaws. We didn't create it. All of us are trying to adapt and grow. Given all the gains women have made in the last 100 years, having a woman president may not seem like that big of a deal. It is. Step back and look at it from the arc of human history. It is still a revolutionary concept for a woman to be in charge. All of our models for a person in power, and certainly for the American president, are based on men. Our founding documents, our theories of leadership and governing, were all written by men, for men. It is time we reimagine leadership roles for women and men both. You will do that for us. You will chart a new course. Women of the baby boomer generation faced these same constraints in all professions. There was no other blueprint to work from other than to show what a woman could do, that a woman could do the job as it had always been done by a man. Follow our model. Be tough. Prove yourself by the standards we set. You weren't even supposed to look like a woman. Dress like a man's version of a woman. Our eyes can handle that. Think of how Patti Smith, Joan Jett, and Pat Benatar, women pioneers in rock music, presented themselves to the world. Leather, black blazers, and denim, our eyes accepted those women tough enough to take on the role meant for a man. Woman with a guitar, woman with a gavel, woman with a podium, woman with an oval-shaped office, women with objects of power. It has taken time for our eyes to adjust to them. You won't have to do that. You will still have a harder time than you should on the campaign trail. Getting the job will be harder for you than actually doing the job. You will be great at the job, by the way. But you will face easier terrain than the last woman did. This time, our eyes will be more accustomed to the sight of a woman standing behind the podium, center stage at the convention. Our ears more attuned to a woman's raised voice projecting, not shouting, into the crowd. Our sensibilities adjusted to focus on what she will do with the job, not question why she wants it. Let's celebrate the fact that you are a woman. I have always thought that I could do any job a man can do just as well as him. Only recently have I come to realize that I don't want to. I want to do the job the best way I can do it, not the way he would. That's what this letter is about, how women can lead in a new way, how we can create a new model of leadership in our own image, not a man's. You are preparing to lead our nation. Whatever you do to ensure that your voice is heard or that your position prevails, you are doing it in the service of our country. You don't see it as attempting to aggrandize yourself or being pushy. You certainly aren't going to wait to be asked for your view. You are going to assert yourself. If you didn't, you wouldn't be doing your job. You wouldn't be giving the country its due. That's an approach all women should adopt. 2 months after the election, millions of women across America and communities from Anchorage, Alaska to Washington, D.C. showed up to make their presence known and voices heard as part of the Women's March. Women of all persuasions found it to be an empowering moment beyond politics. There was a sense among women that we had plateaued and needed to chart a new path if we were to make the progress we wanted and deserved. It was the start of a new chapter in the American story in which women decided that we were no longer following old rules and conventions. We were creating our own game and going to write and tell our own story. This book is for you, our first Madam President, and for all the women in America. This is why I can't talk in shirt. Sorry. And for all the women in America from all walks of life and all professions who know they are ready to lead.
Our hymn is number 148, Let Freedom Span Both East and West.
Thank you.
keep it together. this next reading is an excerpt from a book called Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's actually a book about a man, Paul Farmer, who's an anthropologist and a physician. He runs, he is the chief of the Division of Global Health and Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's a Harvard medical professor. He's written multiple books and articles about Haiti. This book is about him, and it describes him as the man who would cure the world. He is somebody that has supported Haiti. He describes Haiti as the underdog of the underdogs. And this excerpt from the book, I think, has spoke to me about why Haiti has been given a lot of help over the years, and but it's not always helped everybody in Haiti. And you know, people talk about Haiti as having a certain status, like our president referred to them as being an SH status country. And they've taken a lot, and the people that we met there are kind and generous and just really resourceful and amazing. So hopefully this is a little picture of what's happened there over hundreds of years. But anyway, okay. As a scholar and writer, Farmer had taken his greatest pains to assert the interconnectedness of the rich and poor parts of the world, and the dam was his favorite case study. It stops up Haiti's largest river, the Artibonite. I hope I'm saying that right. It's called the Pellegrin Dam, and the impounded waters behind it, the Lac de Pellegrin. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had planned it. Brown and Root of Texas, among others, built the structure in the 1950s during the reign of one of Haiti's American-supported dictators with money from the U.S. Export-Import Bank. It was advertised as a development project, and no doubt some of the people behind its creation believed it as a gift to Haiti. But no one seems to have given much thought to the peasant farmers who lived in the valley upstream. The project was intended to improve irrigation and to generate power. It wasn't as though the peasants of the Central Plateau didn't need and want modern technology, Farmer said, but as they themselves often remarked, they didn't even get electricity or water for their land. Most didn't get money either. In fact, the dam was meant to benefit agribusiness downstream, mostly American-owned back then, and also to supply electricity to Port-au-Prince, especially to the homes of the numerically tiny, wealthy Haitian elite, and to foreign-owned assembly plants. Since the flooding of the valley, many peasant boys and girls from the Kanj, children of what Farmer called the water refugees, had left home looking for work in the capital, where they cooked and cleaned and stitched Mickey Mouse dolls and baseballs, more than a few of them nowadays returning home with AIDS. When Farmer first saw this piece of Haiti and began to ferret out its history, old-timers talked longingly to him about the days before the water rose, when families lived on farms beside the river and everyone had enough to eat and something left over to sell. Some remembered being warned that their land was going to be submerged. But the river had always flowed by, and they examined the dam in progress, and they couldn't believe that a mere wall of concrete would hold back their river. One of the old people of Kanj remembered seeing the water rising and suddenly realizing that his house and goats would be underwater in a matter of hours. Quote, "So I picked up a child and a goat and started up the hillside," end of quote. Families had hurried away, carrying whatever they could to save their former lives, turning back now and then to watch the water drown their gardens and rise up the trunks of their mango trees. For most, there was nothing to do but settle in the steep surrounding hills where farming meant erosion and widespread malnutrition, tending nearer every year toward famine. And for years, there were wailings and curses and loud arguments among old neighbors fighting over titles to land that was left. Things got worse. Even after the dam, most peasants still had their black, low-slung Creole pigs, which they kept like bank accounts to pay for things such as school tuition. But in the early 1980s, they lost those as well. Alarmed about an outbreak of African swine fever in the Dominican Republic, afraid that it might threaten the American pork industry, the United States led an effort to destroy all the Creole pigs in Haiti. The plan was to replace them with pigs purchased from Iowa farmers. But these were much more delicate and much more expensive to house and feed, and they didn't thrive. Many peasants ended up with no pigs at all. When school started the year after the slaughter, enrollments had declined dramatically throughout the country and around Kanj.
Okay, so this congregation, as John Lou said earlier, helped fund my fares for this trip from the social action budget, and I'm extremely grateful for your help in allowing me this amazing experience. That money went towards the people working at the complex that we stayed at, so like the nurses and the cleaners and all that stuff, and that was pretty important. So my mom and I traveled to Haiti with a Manhattan medical mission trip to provide medical aid at the Double Harvest Complex. We left Manhattan early February 18th. We were actually a day late than the rest of the people traveling out by accident. It was miscommunication, but anyways. So we had to go through the customs and immigrations by ourselves. So my mom had already been to another country, but this was my first time, and so that was slightly nerve-wracking going through all the lines and stuff. So in customs, we had four 50-pound bags full of medical supplies, and we were carting them along. It was a kind of struggle. They're really heavy. But we also had our carry-ons with personal items, so we kind of looked like really funny tourists with, like, bags and stuff. The security guard at the customs line asked us, because we told him we had medical supplies, so he asked us if we had medicine, and so we said no, and he's like, okay, fine, you can go. The Double Harvest Complex was about 15 miles away from the airport, but it took us about 2.5 hours to get there. It was already dark, and we had to travel through the extreme traffic in Port-au-Prince. That was a fun experience. And then also, they don't have a lot of paved roads there, so once we got off of the paved roads in Port-au-Prince, it was really rocky and bumpy, and we were sitting in the back seat, and so we were just like, bum, bum, bum. Got a little car sick, but it's fine. So we finally arrived at the complex, and then we immediately started unpacking the bags. So we had the bags contained cans and boxes of food to make during the week. We all took turns making our meals, so we would like leave the surgeries and then make meals for everybody. It had bedding, curtains, and towels, cloth, and that stuff. And then we brought all of our medical supplies that we were going to use. So we had gauze, tools, gloves, gowns, and equipment, etc. So we had to take all of that from the U.S. And so we met a few people that night that were still up and working because it went pretty late most days, and then we pretty much went immediately to bed. This is these are the views that we had. It's not a very good quality picture, but it was really gorgeous. I mean, we arrived late at night, so we couldn't see this, but this is kind of giving you a sense of what we were seeing there. It was beautiful. So why were we there? Through the Double Harvest Complex and Manhattan Medical Missions, we were providing surgeries to people who otherwise would not be able to get them. The only problems that we saw that were directly resulted resulted from the location where the thyroid diseases. That was mainly due to dietary issues, so then we had to remove those. But that was really the only thing from the location. But the other more extreme cases that we saw were mainly due to the fact that they had nowhere to go before to take care of that before we got there. So it led to some extreme cases and times. This is kind of showing you, I mean, we had a lot of people there who were kind of desperate for medical attention. Like I said, medical help wasn't very available to them, which is really sad to see. I mean, on the left there, you can see that's people who were waiting. They slept overnight at the hospital because they didn't get, they were waiting for the surgery the day before, but we just couldn't get to them. On the right, that's our schedule for one of the days, and you can see it was packed, and we just kept adding more and more people on because we didn't want to turn people away, but it was rough to have to make people wait for that. The first day, we woke up around 7 and we got our much-needed coffee and food, and we were introduced. So this was the first day that we went into the hospital, and we were introduced to the whole team there. That was the first time we met most of the people. And then pretty much we immediately went into the hospital. And there were 3 rooms and 3 doctors, and the team was spread out evenly through the 3 rooms. I was mainly in the ENT rooms. There were lots of thyroids, parotid, and dental surgeries there. But the first things I did was bus medical supplies from the back room to the OR, and then gave tools to surgeons because they couldn't. I mean, they were all scrubbed in and sterilized, so then I had to help them out with that. But then the next thing I knew, my mom was asking me to help her remove a breast mass from a lady. So that was pretty fun. That's us on the right there doing that. And that was the first thing that I did, medical-wise, I guess. And then I went straight into the OR after that and scrubbed into for the first time. That's me there. I won't talk about everything I did, and I won't show you all the gory pictures because, sure, not a lot of people want to see that. But, I mean, this is just really an amazing experience for me to get that hands-on experience, and yeah, so that's me. What I will talk about, though, is the people on the team. So they were all extremely kind, helpful, and patient. Now, I'd had no medical experience before this, but they didn't really act like it. They were never annoyed with me. They were all really patient, teaching me how to do stuff, and they were respectful. So this isn't normally an environment that a teenager would be in the U.S. at least, but they didn't really act like that. So yeah, teenagers can be ridiculous at times, I get it, but so can adults, just saying. My point is, the people there took me seriously enough to teach me in a way that they didn't sound like some of the teachers at my school do. So that was really, I really appreciated that and everybody's help. They're all really sweet, and we had translators there that were really kind, and they helped us talk to our patients. There were nurses there who live in Haiti, and they came pretty much every time a team is there, and then they work all week. So the girl in that picture right there, her name's Germana, and she worked pretty much every day, and then she worked night shifts as well, and she barely got any sleep. So I didn't know that, but until one time she was, like, standing in a surgery, and then she was trying not to fall asleep. We're like, oh, my gosh, go sleep. But she just gave it her all, and it was, they were all like that, and it was really beautiful people. Yeah. And also, the people weren't really, our team wasn't really concerned with job titles. So doctors were right alongside nurses and anesthetists and translators and teenagers helping to clean up after surgeries and at the end of the day. And we were all just one big group, and it was really amazing to be a part of that. So I've been interested for a while about going into the medical field, and now I'm even more excited to do so. The experience and knowledge I received from being there with these people was extremely inspiring, and I knew that I wanted to be like them and be able to help people in a significant way. So what I haven't talked about yet is the actual country of Haiti and the people in it. I got a lot of chances to explore our surroundings. Double Harvest had a larger complex across the road from the hospital, and that contained a school, a greenhouse, a fish farm, tons of crops, and chickens, all kinds of stuff. I went there with the 2 other teenagers who went on the trip with me, and I brought some balls for them, and we met a few boys from the school, and we played soccer with them for about, like, 2 hours. It was so fun. We didn't really, one of the kids spoke a little bit of English, but we didn't speak any Creole, but that didn't really matter. We were just playing, and it was a really fun time to be able to meet them. Vendors also came to the hospital to sell stuff to us, and that's just one picture right there. But it was, the whole courtyard was full of beautiful artwork and metalwork and bracelets and stuff, and so that was fun. I bargained for the first time. That was a little scary experience, but yeah, got that under my belt. We also walked to the village, and the village nearby was about half a mile away. So we saw one of the translators there. They usually work there as like a separate job, but they have different professions, I guess. And so one of them was a construction builder, and he is currently in the process of building his own house. So his family lives on the bottom, bottom floor, and then the second floor is that picture on the right there. And so, I mean, I'm pretty sure he was building it off of a building that was already there before, and he's just fixing it up. So, but that picture right there is a lot like houses all over the village, and so that kind of just gives you a sense of what it was like. But we got to see his house, and we got to walk around the village and see people living in that community. And then we also went to an orphanage there, and so the kids were so adorable. On the right, you can see I was taking a selfie there, so I took out my phone, and there are two girls there in that picture that you can see, but there were about 10 climbing all over me at that time of the picture, and they were adorable. There are also many farms and plots of crops around. So it was really green. I'm not a huge mango fan, or I wasn't before I went there, but I ate some mango every day I was there. It was ginormous and amazing and creamy, and like the avocados were beautiful there, and they had really good bananas. And so every day we had a meal that was made from like boxes and cans that I said we brought, so there were a lot of casseroles and stuff. But we also had salads and fruits and veggies from the farms that I mentioned earlier. So we got food from right across the road, and it was really, really good. And there were so many goats, like just standing on the side of the road. There's one right there. That was on our way back from the village, and that was just one of like 20 that we might have saw. They're just, yeah, they're pretty cute. We also used the transportation service of Haiti. So these are called tap-taps. They're kind of, they serve as almost the taxis in Haiti. So, I mean, it's not public transportation, but you had to rent it. But they were basically just pickup trucks with an open back and windows, and then they had paintings all over them, and they all varied. So I'm pretty sure that's Jesus over there painted. And I'm not sure who was on the left, but they had a lot of pop and rap singers, like American. There was Tupac on there somewhere, I'm not sure. Yeah, but it was pretty fun to see all the colorful trucks. And there were people, so people stood on the side of the roads and just flagged down one of these tap-taps, and they just pulled up, and then they hopped on and just grabbed onto the side of the truck and paid their fee and then got to where they wanted to go. And so that was fun. It was pretty populated, so that was happening all over. So overall, we had so much fun there. There were so many fantastic experiences that I'll never forget. I made new friends from all over. They're all wonderful people, and I am so grateful for your help and getting me there and giving me that experience. So thank you.
So if you've got questions or comments for Maeve and Kathleen, why don't you guys come up here?
I'll just add that Manhattan Medical Mission is staffed by local doctors. So on this trip, it was Dr. Ben Pease, Dr. Eric Purdom, and Dr. Leike Evangelides. So they did a combination of ear, nose, and throat surgeries, lots of, like Maeve said, thyroid removals, parathyroid removals. Dr. Evangelides did a lot of urologic surgery, so a lot of, and he did it, yeah, that's right, in hernia repairs. And they donate their time. They're taking time away from their practice. And everybody that goes on the trip pays their own airfare and pays this $300 fee that goes to cover all the services that we get when we're down there. And Manhattan Medical Missions goes down twice a year, and then there are other teams from other areas that come to this medical facility. So I think that's maybe like teams from Miami, there are teams from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and somewhere in Minnesota, I believe. So
Anyway.
Just out of curiosity, when you said that, Maeve, I think you mentioned that there were diet issues that were causing the thyroid problems. Could you, what was the diet problem?
Well, so they don't have iodine in their salt, and so thyroids work off of iodine. I don't know the total science behind it, but basically that the lack of iodine caused those thyroids to grow to be massive. I mean, some of them were, I'm not kidding, like one thyroid was about this big. So, I mean, we just had to remove those. And sometimes I had it on both because there's two. So sometimes I had, yeah. So it was just the iodine pretty much, yeah.
I'm just curious, is this completely private, or is some of this program paid for federally or different charities? Or
through Manhattan Medical Mission? No, I think it's completely private. I don't believe they have any federal funding. Michael would know.
Michael Oldfather, I'm the proud uncle of Ben Pease. And the first time I saw him, he fit in a shoebox, he's bigger than that now. But he asked me to serve on the board as, you know, a doctor who doesn't know anything, and I sometimes provide some help there in not knowing something. But anyway, it is, you know, a great source of family pride, and I'm sure you have some of that too. Thanks for going. And they do take donations, that's
yes,
right.
They do.
Tax free, you know, yeah. Tax deferred or whatever.
I was just curious about your own sort of assessment in terms of both of you. As a country, they've had, you know, loads of problems with natural disasters and obviously the earthquake being the big one. Is there any sense that the country is back to any kind of normalcy? Are they still recovering, or is normalcy just sort of not even a applicable word? Or, I mean, I don't really have a good sense for what Haiti's like.
The people that worked there with us never talked about the earthquake or disadvantages from it, but when you see it, there's lots of rubble still around. It looks like there's not a lot of infrastructure there. There's a lot of trash, so there's no like services to pick that up or even.
And the roads too.
Yeah, the roads are in terrible condition. So one of our translators has just graduated from college. I think he went to the Dominican Republic, and civil engineering and. Looking for a job, there's no jobs for him at all, which they could desperately use, like roads and just basic infrastructure is not there.
Great story. So the Dominican Republic is the other half, right, mm-hmm. of that island. Are they involved in relief programs, Dominican Republic?
Not with this Manhattan Medical Mission
Or in general, are there other groups like yours from other countries?
Yeah, I'm sure there is. In fact, Actually, when I came back, I was talking to one of the nurses that was a traveler. He actually lives in Wichita, but he's involved in a mission that goes to the Dominican. So
right.
There are other, yeah.
And it's a former French colony, is that
yes.
true?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are the French involved? Okay.
No.
And we don't have an embassy there, I would imagine, or do we?
We have
in Haiti.
We have an embassy. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay,
had to register with them before we went.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
One of the classic pictures you see currently is a satellite photo of the island of Hispaniola, and the one half being the Dominican Republic and the other Haiti. And it's very striking. There's a stark line that passes through the island. Mm-hmm. On the Haiti side, it is stripped clean of all vegetation, mm-hmm. except maybe some scrub. And Dominican Republic is lush, yeah. With forests and all kinds of vegetation. The problem they face, of course, is to prevent the Haitians from jumping across the line into the Dominican Republic, which border must be guarded and the Haitians kept out. Recently, I read a biography of U.S. Grant, and during his presidency, one of the most active quests in the U.S. Congress was to take over and annex the Dominican Republic, because we had naval bases there, and shoot, we might as well own the whole thing. Yeah. But Congress could never agree. I wonder why. And but the subject of Haiti has always been a puzzling one, because of the French nature of its colonization, and the idea of being for French and British and Americans, let's keep all those black people down on their own island and don't let them in the U.S. or or anything else. So it just remains a real problem, and I'm proud of you all for taking personal responsibility to go in and do what you can.
Yeah. So many of the people that go on these missions have been there multiple times, like 7 and 8 times. Ben Pease goes, like, he's been going from the very beginning. And they were telling us that the first picture that was all farmland around there, that's fairly new. It used to just be like scrub and nothing. And we just saw farmland extensively. So I think these people are finally able to take doing their own thing and building back up what was stripped away.
Question for you guys. I think this kind of intercultural experience is so good for you and so powerful. And people who study these kind of things say that the real transformation comes with reflecting. Mm-hmm. And it's often like the really challenging parts of an intercultural experience that create the kind of growth and transformation in you as a person, in your own development. Were there experiences? I know this is recent. You guys are just beginning to reflect. Mm-hmm. But can you think of experiences you had that you think are those kind of challenging things that make you see your own culture differently in the face of another culture?
Well, I mean, there wasn't a lot in the actual hospital that I feel like, I mean, like I was saying, how they were staying there overnight and there were families waiting out in the waiting room, which is outdoors, and they would just sleep on the benches there. I think that was pretty eye-opening to see that. And then even just walking to the village and seeing how people lived. And I mean, we had soccer balls, and they were just like overjoyed to see that. And I think that kind of was also eye-opening. Like I knew there that was kind of the state there, but I mean, just seeing how exciting it was to get that was, important, I feel like, to see that, yeah.
Yeah. There's black people and white people flying into and out of Haiti, and most of the white people had mission T-shirts, like very, like Christian-based, but when we were standing in line for this, we were getting in the immigration line, and just somebody with their T-shirt on about, you know, just made these really rude remarks about Haiti being as close to anarchy as you'll ever see, and here this person is coming to help, you know, and it was just really, it was sad. That was like the first half an hour of us being there, and it was just, that was the most shocking thing, I think. Yeah.
So being so young and with limited medical training, had you planned on like participating in the operations and procedures, or like were you prepared for that, or did you just get thrown into that situation?
I mean, honestly, I had no idea what I was going to be doing while I was there. I had kind of asked. My mom was like, I don't know. I mean, you're just going to do what they ask you to. I was like, okay. But yeah, the two teenagers I had said were there as well. So they had been there the day before just because of that travel that day. And they had said that they were doing stuff. They had been scrubbing. And I was like, oh, okay. And so, yeah, I mean, I didn't really know. I knew that was a possibility, but I didn't know exactly what they would have me doing. But they were just like, yeah, do you want to do this and this and this? And so I was like, sure. And, I mean, yeah, it was pretty – they were good teachers. And I think they pretty much had me do everything that they did, just at a smaller scale, obviously, and not as much. But, yeah, they had me doing – I mean, except for actually finding where you need to – it's hard to explain, but they had me doing like the little cuts and stuff. They didn't have me actually doing the whole surgery, but
you don't have to go into that.
Sorry. But yeah, I didn't really know entirely what I was getting into, so that was kind of fun. I mean, surprise.
Yeah, it's what you can do, and like there was one of the nurses there. She did all the sterilization of all the equipment because there was no one else to do it, and one of the sterilizing machines was broken, so we just had to keep. It was this constant overturn of once a surgery was done, she would get the equipment, she'd clean everything, sterilize it. In the meantime, you know, the doctors are mopping the floors, people are wiping stuff down. So it was just whatever they needed you to do. And that's in an operation, you need people to hold retractors and you need people to, like, just do whatever it is and go find this and go find that. And we were kind of all running around from basically 8 in the morning till 11:30 every night. It's never going to be like that. If Maeve does go to medical school, it won't be like that. But
so this might be sort of related to what Katie asked, but maybe a little different. I'm wondering if you got a sense for how the Haitians that you met saw their situation, like if you could tell how they, you know, what they thought of it. Mm. And I asked that because when I was 19, I went on a service trip to Belize with my dad, and we put in electricity in the school. And I remember seeing the poverty that the principal and that the teachers and the kids lived in. But what was striking to me was how proud they were of what they had. Mm-hmm. And that was something I saw that completely differently than what I would have expected. So I guess I'm just wondering if you have something that you noticed.
I mean, I think I saw the same thing in that sense. We went to the orphanage, like I said, and they were showing us around. And even in the villages and the houses that they were living in, they weren't really, I don't know. They were all pretty, I don't know how to describe that.
I think that's, they were very proud of what they had and very, they were very appreciative of the care. But, yeah. I don't think, we were walking around the village and some of the people were like, can I take your picture? And some of the people said, no, you can't. Nope. we're not here for you to take pictures of. But they were very nice about it, but yeah.
Jane Pelletier. I was so pleased some years ago to read Paul Farmer's book, Mountains. Mm-hmm. Beyond Mountains, is that right? Upon Mountains, whatever. It is such a wonderful book. Mm-hmm. And Partners in Health is such a remarkable organization that works all over the world in addition to in Haiti. So did you have any association with the Partners in Health group while you were there? No, you're totally separate from that. I'm happy to know there are other groups. I mean, I didn't know how many other groups worked there beyond Partners in Health. Thank you.
The woman, Diane Cable, who founded this, her parents were missionaries, and I don't know if they were founders of the Double Harvest. It's a church and school, but she was a surgical nurse, is a surgical nurse. I think she's retired now, but their parents were like, come down and do surgeries. And she's like, build us something. So they did. And it's like a big dormitory. And then there's a big medical clinic, and people are there every day. One day was baby, like a pediatrician was traveling through. They have different physicians that travel through, you know, go to different places. And then these three pretty impressive operating rooms, small but impressive, and I think they just built that all themselves. Yeah.
Ann Cowan here. In your conversations with people in the village and whatever, did you hear any political comments either about the United States or about the Haitian government? Any
No.
comments about their wishes or
No.
complaints? None.
We were with one translator, but they didn't really speak to us most of the time, just because there was that language barrier and there's so much of us and so much
yeah.
of them, and then one translator. So we just kind of like.
Yeah, the only people we met in the village was
physically communicated,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. It was the translator's family, and they were lovely. But no political conversations.
This is Bryce again. 38 years ago, I spent a period of time in the state of Minas Gerais in Brazil mm-hmm. as a senior Fulbright lecturer. But I got around into the real seamy parts of the culture. Mm-hmm. And what I want to say is that what was really important about my visit there was the change that it caused in me from a crass American to a different person altogether.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing from you, particularly Maeve, is that that may be the real value of your trip.
That's yeah.
the things that it caused you in your heart to adopt that
yeah.
that you saw there.
Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah.
We're going back, hopefully.
For sure.
What is the significance of that name, Double Harvest? And were you saying it was started by someone whose parents were religious missionaries?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
does it still have kind of a Christian base to it?
Mm-hmm. It does. And they hold church services every morning. There's
yep.
some, every morning. And so we would wake up to them singing hymns, and it was actually really beautiful to hear that. Yeah, and I think one of the people who had been there before told us a story about her parents and how they had started that. I think they had actually been turned down by multiple mission groups, or told that they couldn't start a certain mission, but they somehow pulled it off and then started this. And yeah, it's Christian-based, but it's pure. Oh, well, I think the Double Harvest actually comes from the agriculture side of it. Like I said, there was that complex with all the crops and the chickens and the fish. So I think the main purpose of that side of it, I guess, was just to help start helping local people there start to grow their own crops and teaching them how to farm and stuff. So I think that might be where the Double Harvest part
did they really? Maybe they double crop because of the climate.
Yeah, I'm not completely positive of that. But
Christians, yeah, kind of reminds me of Habitat for Humanity,
yeah.
which is also Christian based.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're wonderful.
Well, I want to thank both of you for sharing with us, and thank you for going and doing this work.
Thanks.
Our closing hymn is number 298, Wake Now My Senses.
Receiving.
Closing words today come from Reverend Tet Gallardo, the first out lesbian Filipino UU minister. And you have a part in this. This is responsive. So your part is, when I change, the world changes.
When I change, the world changes.
We are here to derive meaning in our actions. We are here to abolish prejudice with an appreciation for our diversity and differences. We are here to feel our personal power and capacity to affect the lives of other people.
When I change, the world changes.
We are here to become teachers to each other.
When I change, the world changes.
We are here to spend time away from the usual influences and relearn reality.
When I change, the world changes.
I am here to see that my singular life is a gateway to countless possibilities.
When I change, the world changes.
May the path you travel be blessed.